Consider also Esther. In Esther 2:7, we read about the young woman, also known as Hadassah. She had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. Again, if the biblical view of beauty is that it is something to be sour about, this description of Esther is sorely out of place. We read that Esther had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at, as if that is a good thing. And indeed, as the story turns out, we see that Esther's beauty is a very fortunate thing for the Jews living as Persian captives. Their severe persecution was stopped by Esther successfully interceding with the mighty king who admired her beauty so much. There is, of course, another side of this coin. The admiration of feminine beauty does not always go so swimmingly. Consider Abraham as he passed through Egypt. When he was about to enter Egypt, he said to Sarai, his wife, "I know that you are a woman beautiful in appearance, and when the Egyptians see you, they will say, 'This is his wife.' Then they will kill me, but they will let you live. Say you are my sister, that it may go well with me because of you, and that my life may be spared for your sake." Genesis 12:11-13, ESV. As predicted, when Abram and Sarai enter Egypt, Sarai's beauty is greatly admired. She is seized for Pharaoh, yet God intervenes by afflicting Pharaoh and his house with great plagues. In the end, Pharaoh gives Sarai back to Abram and asks them all to leave. I think we can conclude from such incidents two things about the biblical view of beauty. First, it is a blessing God can use for his purposes. Second, conspicuous beauty among godless men invites danger. Jesus was doubtless familiar with this danger when he taught the following. "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery,' but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart." Matthew 5:27-28, ESV. Yet we have established already that a woman's beauty is, biblically speaking, a good thing, and it surely is neither sinful for a husband to enjoy the beauty of his wife, nor for him to desire her. Quite the opposite, in fact. Consider the latter half of Proverbs 5. "Let your fountain be blessed, and rejoice in the wife of your youth, a lovely deer, a graceful doe. Let her breasts fill you at all times with delight. Be intoxicated always in her love. Why should you be intoxicated, my son, with a forbidden woman, and embrace the bosom of an adulteress? For a man's ways are before the eyes of Yahweh, and he ponders all his paths." Proverbs 5:18-21, ESV. The first part of this chapter warns against adultery. The latter bit presents us with the godly alternative. As usual, God gives us more than just a prohibition by telling us the good thing to pursue instead. That is, God's design is for man to find fulfillment of his intimate desires in his wife and her beauty. This is what he does instead of giving in to temptation. Here the husband is encouraged to rejoice in the wife of his youth. There's nothing about settling. The word is rejoice. This too shows us that beauty and the human body, though they can be misused, are inherently good things God created to be used for the good purposes he intended. Consider again the words of the Apostle Paul. "Because of the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife, and each woman her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer. But then come together again, so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. 1 Corinthians 7:2-5, ESV. Here again, legitimate sexuality is presented as an antidote. Though, if I may say so, Paul's language here is not so poetic as Solomon's. He is very blunt and pragmatic about it all. I think that may have something to do with their differences in matrimonial experience. Note also that Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Paul, by sharp contrast, was single. Perhaps we cannot say this influenced their writings on the subject, but that is hard to believe. Remarkably, both Solomon and Paul say essentially the same thing. Sex with your spouse is better than sexual immorality. Moreover, it provides a safe haven for those who, not content with singleness like Paul, still desire to live godly lives. Nudity, modesty, beauty, and sex. We live in a world which distinguishes between these things very poorly. What then should the view of the Christian be? For instance, saying someone is sexy is effectively the same as calling them handsome or beautiful. I think we barely distinguish between beauty and sex because our culture discourages restraint of the sexual impulse among consenting adults. Yet beauty and sex are not one and the same, and we ought not. Yet beauty and sex are not one and the same, and we ought to encourage restraint of sexual desire within us when it would lead to sexual immorality. Meanwhile, modesty and nudity are viewed as opposites. We say someone is modest to the extent they are not naked. And I have never heard someone described as immodest when they were fully clothed, though this is entirely possible in the biblical definition. that follows that where we talk about the aim of modesty being sexual purity, and where we do not distinguish between beauty and sexiness, admiring someone's good looks is automatically lustful, and we run the risk of confusing beauty with immodesty and ugliness with purity. I think this is very unfortunate and something to avoid. Similarly, biblical modesty does not appear so concerned with how much and which skin is covered as with drawing attention to ourselves and being conspicuously wealthy. At least that is how I read what Paul wrote about braided hair, gold, pearls, and costly attire. Here my wife and I are, raising 6 children in such a world, with a 7th child on the way. What do we tell them about rightly dividing the word of truth on such things? For one thing, fleeing sexual immorality is right and good, yet we should not in that process disparage the good gifts God created. Rightly seen, beauty is a blessing from God. What's more, we should be on our guard in doing such things which are beside the point. For instance, the Muslims who cover their women from head to toe in thick black robes are obviously no purer for having created such a culture for themselves. All too often, when they come to Europe and America and see Western women wearing pants and going around with pretty faces uncovered, those men make an evil habit of raping and molesting as if they had a right to. If you ask me, we might be safer and holier importing all the tribes of mostly naked jungle people. On the other hand, I am thrown for a loop by what is called Free the Nipple, a global feminist campaign in which women are encouraged to go around flashing their breasts in public because men do it, and because of equality. Why does equality not mean that men keep their shirts on also? Yet we have just learned two crucial things in reading the scriptures. First, God does not always give identical instructions to men and women. Gender is not merely a social construct, it is a divine construct. Second, we do not know precisely how much and what of the body is unpresentable. For all we know, the jungle people in their loincloths have the right of it. We cannot see into hearts and minds to know exactly why other people dress the way that they do, but God can. We must then settle for examining fruit to distinguish good trees from bad. To a limited extent, we see something of a person's character in how they choose to present themselves. Yet this is only true so far, especially when you factor in different upbringings and native cultures as influences on what someone thinks they are communicating by dressing this or that way. For instance, the women of some jungle tribes laugh that modern men think of female breasts in purely erotic terms. They ask, are they babies? Meanwhile, many modern people think a mother breastfeeding in public is lewd because of how eroticized the female breast has become in Western culture. We do well to put ourselves in the shoes of missionaries to foreign lands. How would we explain to a Brazilian that toplessness is inappropriate in God's eyes? And how would we reason with a Pakistani that it was perfectly acceptable for us to walk around in our underwear? The point is not that there is no standard. Rather, the standard is to be considerate of the context we find ourselves in for God's glory and the betterment of our fellow man. There is, I think, a limit to this. Or should we start wearing burqas if the Muslims tell us they are offended by our women showing their faces? And what if the feminist promoting Free the Nipple gets offended at our still wearing a shirt? Nevertheless, I believe God is best glorified in this if we try to honor him in our exercise of self-control and decorum, appreciating his gift of beauty even as we strive to be good stewards of it.